The moment Steve Jobs uttered the word iPad yesterday, I thought, who came up with that? We joked on the program that maybe there weren't any women in the room when that got decided, and maybe they didn't watch this 2005 comedy sketch from Mad TV either.
Why use a maxi pad when there's the new iPad from Apple? iPad? With the new iPad, I just hook up my Apple to my Peach, and I can download protection for up to 1,000 periods.
Like that.
And with wireless Bluetooth technology, iPad sets you up for fast uploading without all that water bloating.
Oh, wow, that's great.
That sketch has been all over the internet since Apple announced the iPad. The writers are here with us now. Bruce McCoy is here in the studio in Culver City, and Tammy Sager joins us from New York. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Where were you when you first heard that Apple had actually named their device the iPad?
You know, first thing yesterday morning, even before it was announced, I thought maybe someone leaked it. I saw it on the internet, I think on Twitter, perhaps.
Yeah, I found out from Bruce, actually, from his Twitter, because he tweeted a couple of minutes before it was announced that if it is called iPad, then he wants a residual check. And I was like, oh, this might be something.
And how did you two come up with this sketch?
Well, at Mad TV, we always loved puns. Some people think they're the lowest form of humor. Personally, I think they're the greatest source of comedy. And we were bantering around ideas. Someone said, oh, instead of an iPod, what about an iPad? And Tammy and I thought, what if we merged a iPod commercial and one of those horrible feminine hygiene product commercials? And the end result was the commercial for the iPad.
And also at the time that the iPod commercial was really big, right? It was on TV everywhere.
The big thing was the silhouette dancing at the end. And that was actually the trickiest thing we had to do for that commercial was explaining to the art department our vision for that. Bruce, I think you remember there were a lot of discussions of where exactly this device was going. And it actually contributed to our tagline for it, which was,
the new Apple iPad. Please don't make us explain how it works.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts is seeing those black silhouetted female, all-female dancers with the iPad.
Yes, exactly.
So you two worked on this together?
We did. This one we wrote rather quickly, which I think is usually a sign of a good sketch when it just kind of flows right out of you. No pun intended, I'm sorry. but, you know, it was kind of a silly idea. We could use as many puns about feminine hygiene products and computers as we could, and we crammed them into a minute and a half.
Apple itself, I think, is very spoofable, right?
They really are. We've done other Apple spoofs on the show, and as soon as we heard the name iPad, you know, everyone across the world, that's where your mind went to.
I think you nailed it when you said, oh, there must not have been a woman in the room when they said this, because it's just, it's so obvious. It's so obvious that we wrote it.
So obvious you wrote it,
yeah,
5 years ago.
Right.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bruce McCoy and Tammy Sager wrote the Mad TV sketch on the iPad. You can see it at our All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Whether Apple's new tablet computer, the iPad, takes off or not, the fact is more people are using mobile devices, and they're downloading more and more video, more software, and other big chunks of data that are clogging up the bandwidth. We spoke with our technology commentator Mario Armstrong about how much of a problem this is for consumers and for wireless carriers. Mario, welcome.
Ah, Ari, thanks so much for having me in.
Well, right now, today, is the lack of bandwidth a problem?
Absolutely, the lack of bandwidth is an issue. I mean, you can look at numerous reports or just look at some of the disgruntled consumers that are out there that are complaining about wanting to be able to do more with these devices but feel like they're a little hamstrung because the networks seem to be overwhelmed.
How much of a factor is that when Apple introduces a high-profile new product like the iPad?
You're absolutely right. When you start looking at how many more devices can we add to the mix? A Kindle is one, and then we have a netbook. We also have a data card from Verizon. Verizon, a Droid, an iPhone. So all of these devices are consuming much more of the network's capabilities than we would have ever really imagined. One thing that may help to shift this a little bit is the idea of tiered data plans.
What is that?
And so that means the idea of maybe you consume only a little bit of data on your smartphone or on a device.
I just check email. I'm not streaming video.
That's correct. And maybe I'm just a hog. Maybe I just love broadcasting myself walking into the NPR studio, which, by the way, I did on my way in here. I'll show it to you. I did that live from the iPhone using an application. So the point is maybe I should pay a little bit more for my service because of my usage of the network versus you.
Okay, well, let's give this a try. You filmed yourself walking into the NPR studio?
Yes. And in fact, I'm going to take it a step further, if that's okay with you. I'm going to start streaming us live. So I'm going
to
hand you the phone.
Tie. Okay.
I'm going to hand you the phone. You can actually see video,
yep,
right, on the phone.
There you are.
Right now, we are broadcasting live on my website. If you were to go to my website and pull that up or go to ustream.com, you would be seeing us in studio right here. And that's being handled from an iPhone.
And relatively speaking, this uses a lot of bandwidth.
Relatively speaking, a lot of bandwidth. I mean, it's nowhere near like listening to an NPR podcast versus streaming live video. Two totally different and significantly different uses of data.
Now, I got to say, as I'm watching you in the iPhone, it's not a fluid streaming image of you. It freezes for half a second, and then it jumps forward, and it freezes for another half second. Is that the problem we're talking about?
That's exactly what some of the issue is in terms of streaming. I mean, it's still obvious when I travel to California or to New York or to other places, I'm still dealing with drop calls on multiple devices and not the best data connectivity at all times.
You know, we've been talking mostly about Apple products like the iPhone and the iPad. There are other competitors out there that use different networks created by BlackBerry, Palm, things like that. Could the problems with bandwidth make one of these competitors a front runner just because people get faster service and they're able to do what they want to do?
You're picking a great point right there. That is an absolute unique differentiator. I mean, we still see the advertisement for these companies all talking about connectivity. Who has the largest coverage area? Who has the fastest speeds? That's going to continue to evolve as a differentiating point for consumers as the need becomes more prevalent for people to want to download larger files or stream broadcasts. And that's for all telecommunications companies. A problem that they have to step into is, you know, how much are we going to allocate our network to Wi-Fi versus cellular versus other means of connectivity, and how fast can we get it done?
Well, Mario, I can see that your iPhone battery is almost dead, so I'm going to let you go. Thanks a lot.
Been sucking up too much juice. Thanks for having me in.
Mario Armstrong's Morning Edition's regular technology commentator, and he also hosts the radio show Digital Cafe on Baltimore Public Radio Station WYPR.
Some pockets of the country have no real high-speed internet access at all. Last year's stimulus package included more than $7 billion to increase broadband access to rural communities. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is in charge of distributing some of the money.
And this week they awarded more than $300 million in grants. The money funds 14 projects from Alaska to Alabama. Not everyone is happy with the program. Yesterday, Alabama's Republican Senator Richard Shelby called it wasteful spending by the Obama administration. Well,
this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, how one group of self-described geeks is hoping to transform Michigan's sputtering economy. They call themselves the Geek Group. They're based in Kalamazoo, and they've set up what is essentially a nonprofit sandbox there for high-tech experimentation. Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Radio met up with the group's founder, and he got a tour.
Chris Bowden likes to say that he hacked college. He went to classes. He lived on campus.
But I never enrolled. I couldn't afford to. But I wanted to learn. And I found very quickly that if you actually have a sincere, passionate desire to learn, and you don't care about the degree, that the whole world is a school.
Bowden never got a degree, but he kept the passion, which led to creating the Geek Group. It has members all over the world, but the headquarters is here in an old machine shop just north of Kalamazoo. Bowden says anyone can come here and just play.
It's like if you could go to Mythbusters and hang out. It's a real place.
It almost even looks like the set of Mythbusters, with crazy experiments all over the place. Like a nuclear fusion reaction inside a small glass container.
That's a star in a jar.
Next to that, there's a magnetics demonstration that shoots an aluminum disc straight up to the ceiling. There's also a high voltage lab where Bowden demonstrates the thumper.
It's like the finger of God.
He sets a Mountain Dew can on a piece of metal attached to an obscene amount of electrical power.
All right, you ready?
We stand back 30 feet, and Bowden tells me to mash a big red button.
Okay. I promise this won't hurt. I promise not to kill you.
All right. Okay.
The can is vaporized, and I can still feel the thump in my chest. This place is a geek's dream house. Liz Bocht first heard about the Geek Group while surfing the internet 6 years ago. She was living in Toronto at the time.
I came here and I saw all of the really awesome machines and toys that I knew that I had wanted to use for something, but there was no way I would ever be able to get one for myself.
After one visit, Bocht decided to move to Kalamazoo, and she's now executive director of the Geek Group, which is a nonprofit, staying afloat largely through donations and grants. But it also serves as a kind of R&D facility for small companies that can't afford their own lab. And this is what gets Chris Bowden really excited. He takes me into a room with a computer numerically controlled milling machine that anyone can use to develop prototypes.
This machine creates jobs. It doesn't just make parts. It doesn't just make metal shavings and plastic shavings. This makes jobs.
That's what brought in Pat Hanna, who runs a company called 1-2 Products. His eyes light up at all the science experiments, but he came here for a much more practical reason.
Well, we had developed our product that we're hoping these guys can help us with, and we were looking for somebody to do some simple machining and also to keep it quiet for a little while.
The Geek Group charges for some of this work. It's one of the many ways to keep the lights on, and they do use a lot of electricity here. The insurance bills are also through the roof. But Bowden has a vision to expand the Geek Group, build a 40-acre campus, but without degrees or tuition, a place where people could do what he calls open-source research and development.
But I can't get economic development to care, because we're the weird guys. We're the guys out on the edge of town that blow stuff up.
Bowden believes the Geek Group would get more attention if it were in Silicon Valley, but Silicon Valley doesn't have the kind of unemployment that's ravaged Michigan, or the manufacturing heritage and making things with your bare hands. He believes that this is a place that could use some weird people on the edge of town. This is a place that could use some real geeks. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me as usual. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Michelle. Well, political and media circles here in Washington, D.C. are abuzz about the saga of former North Carolina senator and presidential hopeful John Edwards. Now, last week, after previous adamant denials, Edwards admitted he did father a child by his mistress, Riel Hunter. And this week, we're hearing reports that John and Elizabeth Edwards have legally separated.
And Lee, we can always count on our very own Tell Me More producer, Alicia Montgomery, to rattle our blog readers. Alicia wrote a post last week taking issue with marital infidelity by public figures. She said it suggests a great deal about their integrity as leaders, but not everybody agreed. We caught up with blogger Matthew, who posted this response.
If Americans would grow up, then John Edwards would not have had to scuttle around trying to cover his track so desperately. It would also have helped if he had better taste in women and better sense with sex. Wear a condom, man, and for good measure, find a lover who doesn't want to get pregnant. If Americans realize that one's sex life has no connection to one's presidential or leadership abilities, then none of LaFaire Edwards would matter to anyone besides those directly involved.
Well, thank you, Matthew. Tell us what you really think. Lee, any updates?
Yes, a few updates, Michelle. In December, we spoke with the president of Jackson State University, Ronald Mason, who, along with the heads of two other historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, Alcorn State and Mississippi Valley State University, opposed Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour's proposal to merge the schools. But now Mason seems to have had a change in his perspective about a merger. We've obtained a copy of a PowerPoint presentation made by Mason that does, in fact, call for the three schools to be merged into one. And this week he told a Mississippi newspaper that such an idea, quote, really would be a model for the next generation of HBCUs. Now, we asked Mr. Mason to explain the apparent shift, and he issued a statement that reads in part, quote, I simply offered one suggestion on how to survive and get stronger. Now, the full statement will be available on our website, and we've invited Mr. Mason back on our program, Michelle, to explain the change in his thinking.
Good idea.
And finally, about this time last year, we reported on a tragic story out of Oklahoma. Oakland, California, 22-year-old Oscar Grant, an unarmed black man, was shot and killed by then-transit police officer Johannes Mescherle, who is white. Now, the shooting was captured on videotape, and the incident sparked outrage and rioting in the city. Mescherle has since resigned and is waiting to be tried on murder charges. But Wednesday, Michelle, city transit officials announced a $1.5 million settlement for Grant's 5-year-old daughter, Tatiana.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Caves are some of the last places on the planet left to explore. Though caving is relatively safe, if something goes wrong deep inside the earth, a rescue can take days, in part because cell phones and walkie-talkies don't work underground. But now a remarkable teenager in New Mexico has invented a device that may significantly speed the rescue process by allowing cavers to text from deep underground. As Brad Horn reports from Carlsbad, New Mexico, the young man's invention may have other applications as well.
The kid is smart. So smart, he says stuff like this.
I rewrote my receive program and added a noise rejection system that can throw out Navy beacon pulses that get intermixed with my signal, and so that way...
16-year-old Alexander Kendrick won the 2009 International Science Fair for inventing this cave texting device. The award got the teen from Los Alamos, New Mexico, a new computer, a trip to Switzerland, and $12,000 in checks. I wanted to find out why this thing was such a big deal. And the next thing I knew, I was hanging from a rope in the bowels of the earth and groaning under my breath.
God help me.
I was with a team of cavers in Carlsbad Caverns National Park in New Mexico, heading 1,000 feet underground to test Kendrick's invention, which is something like a computer attached to a ham radio. It transmits data using low-frequency radio waves that can penetrate rock more easily than high-frequency transmissions like those in FM broadcasts. If this test succeeded, it would be the deepest known underground digital communication ever to take place in the United States. And why would anyone want to text from nearly 1,000 feet underground? Here's why. In a 1991 New Mexico cave rescue, it took 170 people 4 days to save a woman with a broken leg. The rescue team had to lay miles of telephone line in order to stay in touch with the surface. If they'd had Alex's radio, the rescue time may have been cut in half. That could make the difference between life or death. The other reason this thing is a pretty big deal?
Come and I'll show you the lab.
Science. This is Diana Northup, a microbiologist at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
There are some nasty chemicals here in the lab, so don't touch stuff.
Her research lab is full of cave bacteria in petri dishes. Northup tells me that scientists find microorganisms in these deep caves that might have the potential to kill superbugs.
Microorganisms that live in such a low-nutrient environment actually put out antibiotics. They produce them.
But scientists think one of the biggest threats to this emerging source of antibiotics is actually the scientists themselves. People contaminate the sensitive cave environment just by being there. In fact, researchers believe the more they visit the cave, the less likely they are to find antibiotics there. Northup thinks that by connecting data recorders to Alex's radio, scientists could remotely transmit information about the cave environment.
So a cave radio that allows you to beam data to the surface rather than visiting it in person can be extremely valuable. It could save the cave.
Back in the cave, we've arrived at the test spot, exactly 946 feet underground. The radio is being set up on the edge of a big pool of blue-green water pocked with stalagmite islands. It was 68 degrees but incredibly humid. Alex and the team pulled pieces of white PVC tubing from their backpacks and assembled the radio's antenna, which looks like a 6-foot-wide tic-tac-toe frame with wire wrapped around it. His dad, Brian, was about to hike to an identical unit sitting directly above us on the surface.
So now we have 2 hours to get in place.
1 hour and 59 minutes, actually.
Are you getting nervous?
No.
You're making me nervous.
They synchronized their watches, and Brian and another caver climbed the steep, dusty slope above us. And then we waited. 2 hours later, after calibrating the devices, Alex typed the word happy on a rubber keyboard and pushed send. Up above on the surface, his father stared at a small screen, hoping to see the word.
4, 3, 2, 1. Here it comes. Let's hope. Any second now, he should send us something. Let's hope. So we missed the H, but yep, we got Appy. That's excellent. We got it. That's digital data coming through at 950 feet, roughly.
Now Alex has to fine-tune the radio to make it smaller and tougher and easier for rescue crews to get down into caves. That'll have to wait, though, because he's busy working on his 2010 Science Fair project, a device that finds underground rivers by measuring their electromagnetic currents. I don't know what problem he'll solve next, but I hear there's this thing called global warming. For NPR News, I'm Brad Horn.
And if you want to see photos of Alexander Kendrick's cave radio test, go to npr.org. Here's a disturbing fact. Studies show that only about 40% of healthcare workers in this country wash their hands as often as they should. So some hospitals are testing new surveillance technologies to monitor their employees' hand-washing habits. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Dubin has more.
The standard protocol in hospitals is for doctors and nurses to wash their hands on the way in to see a patient and on the way out. But that doesn't always happen. They get busy, they forget. Happens to everyone. Even Lindsay Ann Stone, a nurse at Princeton Baptist Hospital in Birmingham.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
How are you feeling today?
Well, it's still pretty severe.
Yes, ma'am. You let us know if you need anything, but we'll be back, okay?
All right.
Wash your hands is a message Stone and her colleagues have heard over and over again.
Through orientation and bulletins that they put up and hand hygiene pamphlets and posters and everything that you can imagine, it's all over.
Stone says she washes her hands a lot. She guesses at least 100 times a day. But hand washing is kind of like exercise. You don't do it nearly as much as you think you do. So hospital administrators installed new devices to track her hand hygiene. With information transmitted wirelessly through a special badge that she wears, they can tell when she entered a patient's room, whether she washed her hands, and whether she washed again on the way out. That information is then recorded and sent to hospital officials. When she first heard about the new system, Lindsay Ann Stone says she had mixed feelings.
I was excited, but to be honest, I was a little nervous, wondering how it was going to directly affect me as an RN.
For one thing, she and her colleagues wondered how this information, a sort of nice and naughty list on hand washing, would ultimately be used. Harvey Nix is the CEO of Preventix, the company that developed the monitoring system at Princeton Baptist. He says it's meant to be more a gentle prod than punitive.
If they're habitually not complying, we could actually send them an email or send them a text message, something that goes to them personally.
Still, most people aren't thrilled about being monitored. So the Centers for Disease Control is trying to gauge how healthcare workers feel about these new devices. CDC epidemiologist Kate Ellingson says they're using focus groups to help tweak the technology. She says they're asking a number of questions.
Not just how do you like it, what do you think of it, but do you see this as something that you would pay attention to that would change your behavior?
Ellingson says improving hand hygiene among healthcare workers has been a real challenge, and that's come at a cost. According to the CDC, healthcare-associated infections kill about 100,000 Americans a year and cost billions of dollars. For NPR News, I'm Gigi Dubin in Birmingham.
This is NPR News.